in the dark. I need a decent night's sleep. I need to get out of here. Quell flinched and slowly rose. Aiden was a silhouette against the lighter shadows of the cave mouth. If you have a suggestion, I'm glad to listen. You're the one in control of the working group. There is no working group, Aiden cried, half laughing. There's only you and me, and enough chemicals to make my blood catch fire. What do you want me to tell you? Quell mouthed the words to make sure she'd heard them correctly. You're not making sense. I am the only one making sense. They all need me, you understand? I do everything I can. He stepped forward, and Quell saw something feral in his expression. He sweated despite the cold air, despite dehydration, despite their rest. And you're the one who ruins worlds, who kills families. She should have felt compassion. He was clearly hallucinating. Maybe one of his wounds had been infected. He smelled foul enough, and that infection had spread to his blood. Maybe it was simply the pain he was going through. But she felt nothing for Aiden, and when he lunged awkwardly, she dug her heels into the rock and braced to push him backward instead of stepping aside. He was stronger than she'd expected. He bowled into her with enough force to make her right heel slip and her knee strike the cave floor. Pain flashed up her thigh, and she shouted, feared a fracture, and abandoned all gentleness as she shoved Aiden away. Aiden wobbled but caught himself against the cave wall. He wasn't armed, she was confident in that, but neither was she, and she'd never been any good at hand-to-hand fighting. She could stop him, but she wasn't certain she could do so without accidentally cracking his skull or breaking one of his legs. Aiden came at her again, shouting incoherently, and she rose in time to catch him and spin with the momentum. They whirled together, and she drove her left knee into his groin, shoved him off her once, then twice. She prepared to punch him when he staggered backward with eyes wide. He dropped to the ground, catching himself on his hands. Behind him, in the dark, floated the red bead Quell recognized as the interrogation droid's photoreceptor. She couldn't see the needle in the droid's manipulator, but she knew it was there. Aiden shuddered and fell.
The sedation should last several hours, the droid said.
Where were you? Quell asked. She sounded hoarse, and she breathed heavily.
I decided not to power down while you rested. The odds that I would fail to awaken seemed low, but not non-existent, given the damage I've sustained. I thought I would scout ahead rather than waste battery power in the cave.
Warn me next time. Quell knelt beside Aiden, and the droid descended over his body. What's wrong with him?
The list of his injuries is extensive. You're asking about the delirium?
The whine of the droid's repulsors rose to an insectoid buzz.
I do not detect any infection. It may be an after-effect of medication in combination with anxiety and malnutrition. I believe it will pass if he can be restored to bodily health.
She met the machine's gaze. What do we do?
We must remove him from this planetoid as swiftly as possible. In the meantime, he should not be forced to travel. It will only worsen his condition.
Quell wanted to sit on the stone next to Aiden. Instead, she stood. Once again, she wondered how long she'd managed to sleep. I'll keep going. You stay with Aiden. She began sorting her belongings and dividing the remaining stores of food and water. Behind her, ITO said,
I'll accompany you.
Aiden needs someone to care for him.
I believe he can care for himself, and my supply of medication is nearly exhausted.
Care for him anyway.
Erica?
The droid said her name, and she turned, shoulders tight. What?
I found something while scouting. You need to follow me.
The black hole was out of sight as Quell marched across the red wastes, eternally one step behind the interrogation droid. The valley was now narrow enough to be called a canyon, And as they traveled, it split once, twice, three times. Always they followed the left-hand path, though the branches all looked the same to Quill. Eventually, the ground sloped upward, and they came onto a mesa overlooking the fractured lands, unnaturally topped with sand that billowed at every breeze. Quell climbed dunes and pulled her shirt over her mouth and nose, wishing she'd brought her flight helmet. The tower formed gradually out of the night, taking shape where stars were absent against the sky. From a distance, it might have been a natural obelisk, a gargantuan version of the black stones that erupted during the worst of the quakes. As Quell's eyes adjusted and she strained to take it in, however, she saw that the top of the tower was ornately forked, two individual spires rising from the central mass, arcing and coming together to frame an opaque lens that dully distorted the stars behind it. There was nothing Quell could see at the base of the tower. There was no path through the sand, or even the corpse of another stormtrooper to indicate the location had significance. She thought of what Aiden had said about sites targeted by Operation Cinder. "Do you know what it is?" she asked the interrogation droid.
"This is as close as I came," the droid replied.
She wished she hadn't spoken. Speaking aloud felt profane. Closer to the tower, she could see that it had indeed been carved of the Quake Stone, apparently from a single piece. Its surface was broken by a circuit maze of shallow, nearly imperceptible grooves. Inset in the tower base was a massive rectangular door formed from a metal the same color as the rock, distinguished only by its marginally more reflective luster. The tower's antiquity was obvious from the weathering of the stone. What had once, Quell suspected, been perfectly square corners were rounded from centuries, from millennia, perhaps, of wind and sand. Quell felt instinctively certain that the tower was older than anything on Katadra. Her memory drifted to the Jedi temple she'd visited on the Harkrova moon, and that memory led to a vaguely recalled word she'd encountered somewhere among Rebel propaganda videos. Sith. She couldn't recall the word's meaning, though she tried. The tower door was sealed and did not acknowledge Quell's presence. She saw no way to open it. She found no controls, and when she leaned into the icy metal with her shoulder, it did not give. She circled the tower three times as the black hole crested the horizon and found nothing of interest nearby. The droid did not follow her, instead remaining near the entrance.
"There is machinery concealed here,"
it announced when she returned.
"Sophisticated biosensors installed within the edifice."
"What does it do?" she asked.
"The equipment could be programmed to scan for a specific biophysical signature, that of an individual, a bloodline, or a species. Given the location, perhaps this is the locking mechanism."
"The door automatically admits anyone coded for access?"
"It is possible. Alternatively..."
The droid hesitated and hummed. Quell wondered if it was analyzing gathered data or simply deciding what to tell her.
"The equipment is significantly more advanced than required for a baseline genetic reading. It could be calibrated to read physiological responses."
She parsed the words. "Meaning what? It's mood activated?"
"I do not know,"
the droid said. "There might be nothing inside. This whole place might be useless to us."
"I acknowledge the possibility,"
the droid said. Quell craned her neck and stared. She'd been studying the tower a long while when the lens began to glow, refracting the warped, fiery light of the ascending black hole. Quell stepped backward, maneuvering so she could look through the prongs crowning the structure. The lens seemed to ripple and flare with every motion. She felt detached from her body as she observed, vaguely aware of the wind, but fully focused on the eye rising into view.
She recalled watching an eclipse as a child aboard Gavanna Orbital, staring through polarized goggles, watching the orb of a moon cross the path of the sun too slowly to fully perceive. She'd been transfixed then as she was now. The burning eye reached the center of the lens. The pupil pulsed as if the lens's curvature altered with each beat of her heart and caused the black hole to expand and contract. The iris became the outermost boundary of her vision, and her attention was pulled inward. She felt the tug of gravity, and she fell into the dark, into the crushing grip of the black hole, into the cold of space, into the blackness of her mind. When her sight returned, she was enveloped by the bright yellows and blues of a silt storm. Mud sprayed her face and plastered her hair as she walked through a rising bog already as deep as her thighs. The chill did not disturb her. She looked around at domed buildings formed from rough duricrete as they were blasted by the wind and painted with fierce hues. Thunder rumbled, barely audible over the scream of the storm and the shriek of ion engines high above. Irika Quell knew exactly where she was. Ahead of her, down a flooded street, a lighthouse swayed in the gale. Lightning flashed and struck the top, sending stone plummeting to the mud and leaving metal scaffolding aglow. She heard yelling and turned to watch churning floodwaters slam a white-haired man against the side of a house. The tides of the storm battered him against the duricrete over and over, and each cycle he attempted to grasp a window frame from which arms extended, trying to grasp him, to no avail. Quell couldn't tell whether he'd gone limp before or after he was swept away. The window sealed shut as the mud rose. Quell knew the home's inhabitants would not survive. No one survived Necronus. The houses drowned. The airspeeder pilots who fell out of the clouds drowned. Metal doors tore from their hinges, and the storm entered apartments and schools and workshops. The scream of TIE engines echoed. Quell watched it all, taking no action as the mud rose to her neck and the street became clogged with corpses. Her hands found clammy skin ravaged by blasts of silt. She felt the wind thrash the barriers in her mind until the utter indifference that gave her safe harbor cracked and splintered and tore away, until the horror of it all saturated her in an instant. Then she was no longer among the victims of Necronus, but flying in a TIE fighter, firing at the planet's defenders to protect her squadron and committing to the plan, the strategy that Major Soren Keyes had laid out and the Emperor's messenger had decreed. Quell stepped back through moments, defying the flow of time, and saw each choice she had made that had allowed her to keep fighting, to keep stoking the storms of the planet. She could have turned on her squadron. She could have sabotaged the bombers. She could have sent a message to Necronus en route or convinced her comrades not to act, or strangled Major Keyes aboard the Pursuer. Instead, she had done everything possible to ensure the success of Shadow Wing's mission and reduced a world to a swamp where the dead would mummify and remain uncounted for centuries to come. This was the legacy of Irika Quell, and nothing she could ever do would change it. When she saw the Black Tower and the red sands of the nameless planetoid again, she was on her knees. She convulsed with cold and retched, trying to purge herself, but nothing came.
"You were incapacitated for some time," the droid said. "Several hours, perhaps. I have been monitoring your life signs."
She remained on her knees, her forehead buried in her arms against the dust. She must have looked like she was praying, but the position tamped down her nausea. "I'm alive?" she asked.
"You are alive," the droid said. "And you are suffering. I offer you my sympathies for what little they are worth."
She nodded. Her chin touched sand. She forced herself to lift her torso upright. It was the tower, she said.
Yes,
the droid agreed.
The tower was also monitoring your life signs. The scanning equipment in the edifice was active throughout your experience, and the mechanisms appeared to respond dynamically.
She looked at the droid. Respond how?
I am not entirely certain. It appeared that the deeper you withdrew from consciousness, the more processing power the equipment in the doorway demanded. Additional scanners came online at biophysical thresholds, keyed to your heart rate, brain activity, and more.
Quell considered this. She was surprised by the clarity she mustered, despite the lingering sensations of mud and corpses against her skin. It was looking for something from me, she said. Looking for a specific reaction before it opened.
That is a possibility.
Then I need to do it again to get inside. I need to get it right. The droid's humming seemed deeper than usual, like a recording played at half speed.
You would need assistance. You would need to determine the full array of biophysical conditions the door requires, and how to bring yourself to that state.
Quell paused, unsure what answer she would receive if she spoke again. You can help me, she said.
Yes,
the interrogation droid replied. Two. Life among the cultists was at once numbing and excruciating. The woman known to the children of the Empty Sun as Maya Halleck was designated a Seeker of the First Insight. That meant, essentially, she had access to select areas of the palace compound. She got to pick out her meals before the faithless refugees, but after the 400 cultists who joined up earlier than Maya. And she was welcome to sleep indoors when the ash sleet came down. Chas wasn't sure if the ash sleet had just been sleet before the New Republic's liberation of Katadra. She chose not to ask. In return for the privileges of being a junior cultist, Maya Halleck was expected to join the prayer songs each dawn. She found she recognized the melodies from songs in her lost collection, but the lyrics had been changed from paeans to ancient civilizations to pabulum about community and fellowship. Each morning, she grew stiff with outrage, yet nearly wept at the song's beauty. She was expected to speak to those outside the cult only when encouraging them to join, otherwise building relationships with fellow children. She largely abided by this, deciding anyone not part of the cult was too useless to bother with. She was expected to help with cooking and sweeping and patching the crumbling walls of the palace. Most of all, she was expected to watch broadcasts from Ledich, the fungus-faced woman who had founded the Children of the Empty Sun and called herself not Sweet Bishop or Holy Carnifex or Enlightened Mother, as Chas had bet with herself beforehand, but Vessel. This morning, she'd chosen to lecture on galactic politics.
There's no use in distress over the return of the Empire to Katadra. One oppressor is the same as another,
the hologram said.
It's true that Emperor Palpatine and his deputies thought little of us, thought little of any of Katadra's sects, and there were once many. Yet the New Republic differs in its words, not its deeds.
Chas sat in a common area where cultists normally cooked and played cards and listened to headsets. It might have been the refugee camp on Troyth. Only every single person put down their cards and pots and headsets and looked up at Ledich when the broadcasts began.
Imperial soldiers openly disdained non-humans, and the ruling class did little to intervene. But how often have we heard the New Republic Chancellor talk about ending xenophobia while handing out medals to all human death squads? We've met the New Republic's troops, and it is still humans who outnumber the rest. The Empire forced religious orders from Katadra to Jeddah to truck with smugglers and embezzlers simply to survive, no matter how we might have wished otherwise. The New Republic calls a self-proclaimed Jedi Knight one of its greatest heroes. Can we trust it not to endorse that sect's rebirth above all others?
The speech was delivered without anger. Lettage, as she always did in her lectures, spoke with serenity and placid amusement. It was almost enough to keep Chas's attention.
Yet, seeking peace through bureaucracy is a fool's errand. So what does it matter whether it's the Empire or the Republic, old or new, dropping bombs? The only true peace is found in the Force, and the Force is cultivated through harmony and community and the vision of blessed individuals.
Half a dozen cultists seated near Chas mouthed the last sentence along with Lettage. Chas found her own lips moving and barely refrained from spitting on the floor. You're here for a reason, she told herself. You're not one of them. Every lecture led down the same path. Each began with a bitter truth about the galaxy. Each ended with the promise that the Children of the Empty Sun were the reaction and solution to that bitter truth. It was an old con artist's trick. You accepted the former, it was easy to accept the latter. Chas snatched a headset off a blanket and clapped it over her ears. It was easy, but only a simpleton actually did it. When she wasn't pretending to be a good cultist, Chas Nechatic abandoned the pretense of Maya Halleck and searched the compound. The palace's marble hallways were vast, decorated with gilded pools empty of water, save one, where people crouched and scrubbed laundry. Dark alcoves contained bedrolls and cutlery and children's toys. In some chambers, the ceilings had collapsed, though these rooms were largely empty and the draft was blocked by plastic curtains affixed to doorways with gobs of gray sealant. She didn't expect to find anything useful in the areas of the palace she was permitted to wander, but she memorized the locations of sealed doors and access-restricted lifts. She watched the cult's trusted members disappear down stairways guarded by muscular Gamorreans and a spidery harch. Once, she tried to walk the outer perimeter of the palace to figure out how large it really was, but she got lost in the Katadrin streets and didn't try again. Somewhere, the cult had a prisoner they'd taken after the battle with Shadowwing. Chas grew more confident in this daily. She caught snatches of conversation referring to the guest more than once, and had to resist the urge to throttle the speakers and demand more information. The cult probably had a ship primed to evacuate its leader in the event of riot or rebellion somewhere, too. Maybe even a hyperspace transmitter Chas could use to contact the New Republic. She would find them all, but the prisoner first. She was scouting the lower reaches of the palace one afternoon when the sound of chanting led her into a wide chamber lit a fiery, flickering red. The noise emitted from a small black speaker that doubled as a lantern, suspended above what appeared to be a cremation furnace. A robed cultist stood beside the conveyor, surveying a procession of refugees approaching like peasants before a king. Chas observed through the doorway, careful to conceal herself. A long-eyed Grand stepped forth from the line, knelt before the cultist, and, to Chas's bewilderment, held out a rifle in both hands. "Do you forgo violence and the instruments of violence?" the cultist cried, and the Grand nodded. "Do you pledge yourself to the speaker and vessel of the Force who tends to the Children of the Empty Sun?" The Grand nodded again. The cultist grasped the weapon, set it gently on the conveyor, and sent it rolling through the arms of a nullifier field and into the flickering light. "Then welcome, sister," the cultist proclaimed. "Shed the anarchy of rebellion and find truth with us." The Grand moved away, and another cultist passed the Gran a robe folded like a platter, on which sat a gleaming square package that could have been a meal ration. The next refugee in line stepped forward and drew an antique scatter gun, and the process began anew. Chas attempted to suppress a gag of distaste. She wondered how many of the cultists whom she slept beside nightly had given up their weapons and their freedom for a single meal. She focused on the guns. A DH-17 pistol rolled down the conveyor, fed to the fires, probably stolen off the body of a rebel. A primitive beam tube went next. Chas wondered if it had been salvaged from some ancient temple. She felt an eagerness, a hunger and greed she'd forgotten she was capable of. If she had to live with the cult any longer, she intended to do it armed. She indulged the fantasy of racing in, grabbing a gun, and shooting her way out, crawling through the palace like a guerrilla fighter until she'd freed the prisoner and located a means of escaping the planet. Next, she considered her realistic options. Steal a blaster off one of the would-be cultists in line? Smash the lantern and grab a weapon in the dark? The solution came to her, shockingly obvious, when she spotted the cultist's unctuous smile as he accepted another gift. Chas waited 2 hours before the ritual ended, and the donors and cultists filed out a second doorway. The lantern dimmed, but didn't go out. She scampered to the conveyor, lowered her body to the belt, and crept like a stalking cat through the entrance. She could see nothing inside where the fires had burned, but there was no heat. She fumbled, arms outstretched, touching flat lenses and the spokes of gears. She touched grease and jabbed her palm on something sharp. Finally, her hand closed on the leather grip of a holdout blaster. Of course the cult wouldn't destroy the weapons when it could stockpile them instead. The gun's destruction, like everything else in the palace, was a lie. She was out of the furnace in a matter of seconds, off the conveyor and down the hallways so fast she tripped and propelled herself forward by will alone. As she turned a corner, she tucked the weapon into her pants, under her shirt at the small of her back. A moment later, she bowled into a body that howled in surprise. Chas and the newcomer tumbled onto the floor together. She kicked and tried to disentangle herself, reached for the blaster and hoped it was charged as the man, whose face was covered in burn scars, wobbled to his feet, laughing. As Chas regained her footing and clutched the weapon behind her, she recognized him. When his expression changed to one of astonished bliss, she realized that he recognized her as well. "You survived," Groiver cried and spread his arms wide. "You found your way to us." Chas stroked the blaster's trigger guard and watched the man who'd saved her from the Verk at Winkers and from suffocating in the depths of space. If he wasn't a brainwashed lunatic, he was something worse. A willing agent of the Children of the Empty Sun. A knowing part of the con game.
"I guess I did,"
she said, and let her hand fall to her side. She had a gun now. She could always shoot him later. She told Groiver the story of Maya Halleck, whose tale wasn't entirely unlike that of Chasna Chaddock. Maya, too, was a New Republic fighter pilot, and Maya, too, had been raised in a religious fellowship.
"My mother picked it because the leader was Thielen. Said he was the reincarnation of an old Thielen god, and we were following old Thielen customs," she said, before slurping up a mouthful of watery wheat noodles from a narrow thermos in the cult's kitchen. "All lies, of course. Why I reacted badly on the skiff, and at Winkers. Don't really trust cults."
"You came, though," Groiver said. "You came anyway." Chas grunted and sucked up another mouthful. Broth dripped down her lower lip, burning the skin.
"Where else was I supposed to go? Crashed on a strange planet, not a lot of options."
Groiver laughed and rubbed his hands together above a mug full of broth and almost no noodles. Chess was sure he knew she was lying about her reasons, maybe about her name. But he said only, "I'm glad you did. I promise there's no reincarnated gods here." "Spare me," she thought, and waited for him to preach. "Eat," he said, and poured half his broth into her thermos. "Tell me about flying." She saw no escape from the conversation, so they talked. Groiver, it turned out, had never left Cerberon. He spent their meal asking questions about hyperspace travel, what it looked and felt like, whether Chas was brave enough to jump to light speed in a one-person fighter, and on and on. The questions were penetrating, but not insistent, and Chas found she could avoid answering simply by shrugging. Eventually, she asked him, making an effort to sound casual and instead sounding like a drunk woman pretending to be sober. "Anyone else end up here after the battle? Do you know?" "One that I am aware of," he said. "Found adrift, much like you. She's still in the medical suite, I believe." "Huh," Chas nodded. If she asked more, if she asked to see the prisoner, she'd certainly be refused. On the other hand, if she didn't ask, it would be much too obvious she was on to them. "Any chance I can visit?" she said. "Once she's healed, I think," Groiver replied. "Great. So what were you asking about? You said you'd never seen a real sun before?" Each day for the next 3 days, Groiver found Chas after morning prayers and introduced her to cultists she'd previously managed to avoid. A Twilight woman whom Groiver called his niece had a love for speeder bikes that she communicated passionately, if not articulately. She exchanged stories with Chas about repairing engines and the joys of speed. A Claudite changeling admitted to once imitating Leditch and being caught by the cult leader herself. Most of the cultists were Katadrin natives, but a few were migrants. One, Chas was convinced, had been a notorious bounty hunter from the Meridian sector before taking up with Leditch and her crew. Another, calling herself New Dawn, had spent a month on Jeddah and spoke at length with Chas about the 100 sects she had encountered, how they were similar and how they were different, and how many were lost when that holy world had been destroyed. The cultists told Chas about their hopes to expand and build and plant gardens in the city to feed thousands. They spoke about it like it was a normal thing to want, like dreaming of a future outside war and chaos was something that people did. Chas hated how it made her feel, but the comforting presence of her holdout blaster made it tolerable. She had a way out if she needed it. She located the medical suite on the first day, but it wasn't until the evening of the third that she was confident enough in the medic's schedule to slip inside. She strolled past empty cots and over to the private rooms, peering through a small window into each. She nearly missed the prisoner. In the fourth cell, in the corner next to a cot, was a humanoid form. Under the dim light, Chas was confused by how dark the woman's body appeared in contrast with the pale, bruised face. Then she realized it wasn't the body that was dark, but the figure's clothes, black cloth and leather specked with badges and patches and tubing. Tubing? Chess's eyes fixed on a white symbol on the shoulder, the six-spoked crest of the Galactic Empire. "Your Shadow Wing," Chas said. The woman in the Imperial flight suit raised her eyes to the window, but didn't move. "Give me one reason I shouldn't kill you," Chas said.
"New Republic?"
the woman asked. Her voice was hoarse and barely decipherable. Chas nodded.
"You want to get off Katadra as much as I do," the woman said.
Chas raised the blaster and fired through the window. The woman screamed and clapped a hand to her arm where the leather of her flight suit had melted. The medical suite's alarms whined and trilled. "Never try to manipulate me," Chas said. The woman's lips curled into a snarl. Chas ran for her life. Three. Easy now, Will Lark thought, skimming fingertips over the console as if tickling the down of a Seravka. I'd trust you to fly blind, and it's not really so dark down here. But he didn't say the words aloud, because his comm was still open, and the pilots at the other end of the transmission wouldn't put faith in a man who spoke to his ship. Instead, he declared,
15 kilometers. We're making good progress.
And felt like a child unsure of his role.
Who's fast and maneuverable now, huh?
Nath replied.
That A-wing of yours suddenly ain't worth much.
The other pilot's laughter followed. Will was grateful. There were no stars outside his cockpit, not even the false stars of city lights. The only illumination came from his own vessel's emergency beams, painting swaths of rock and stalactites and revealing crevices that seemed too narrow to pass through until, upon approaching, they shucked the illusions of distance and widened to great maws. The tunnels honeycombing Troyth were as broad and straight as avenues and as slender and winding as a battlecruiser's maintenance shafts. Will flew at speeds a landspeeder could have surpassed, giving himself enough reaction time to dip beneath stone curtains or sweep around crystalline pillars. Crashing wasn't his biggest worry, though. More likely was choosing a tunnel so narrow that he'd be unable to turn around. Will didn't consider himself claustrophobic, and he'd gone caving more than once among the cliffs of home. But the weight of a planet was pressing down above him. He had no desire to face Troyth's underworld alone. He had no desire to abandon his new squadron and leave them unprotected. His comm crackled.
There are houses here, whole villages preserved in stone.
Will recognized the voice of Denish Rave, 2 centuries old, 80 years since he'd flown in combat, but as enthused to pilot his souped-up airspeeder as any child of home climbing on to his first mount.
They say there's ghost civilizations buried below the city foundations,
Gorgeous Sue replied through static. Will guessed she was passing through a distant tunnel. She was the most eager of his scouts, too quick to seek shortcuts without asking permission. Sister to the Hook he'd met among the infantry commanders, her massive frame had barely fit inside the humble hovercat's cockpit.
Probably a lot of superstitions we should be glad we don't know about. Ignorance as a defense against local culture,
Ubellico sniffed. The young human spoke with the stentorian articulation and accent of a Hutt. His confident indignation reminded Will of Chas.
Such an imperial way of looking at things. Yes,
Prince Pi agreed with an insectoid chitter and click.
Works well sometimes, though,
Nath said, and the others laughed again. They were Will's squadron now. He barely knew them, but they were his. None of them had slept much since descending beneath the city. The 61st Mobile Infantry had loaded into unarmed rumblers, tunnel tanks, mining transports, and repulsor cars. Those ground vehicles stayed in constant motion, their drivers operating in shifts drawn up by company commanders. The resulting caravan slithered on its long journey toward the Scar of Troyth. Will had been among those who'd approved taking the underground route. It was, according to the charts, far quicker than an overland passage, and less likely to draw attention from Shadow Wing. But the unit had quickly discovered that the charts were out of date, and the aircraft were pressed into service mapping tunnels and caverns. Like the ground vehicles, the aircraft rarely stopped. The mining transports could carry 2 ships during the pilot's rest periods, but no more. Will slept least of all. When he wasn't able to play scout, He was running the pilots through drills, lecturing them about past encounters with Shadow Wing, or drawing up tactical maps. There wasn't space in the tunnels to train properly, so they trained improperly at slow speeds or at distances measured in meters instead of kilometers. Even when Will's A-Wing was docked with the caravan, he was busy discussing plans with Carver or checking the progress of the infantry's engineers. Two additional craft were still being refurbished, a repulsor craft Will doubted could ever be upgraded to suit his squadron's needs, and a rusting Clone Wars starfighter Nath had called a V-Wing. The latter resembled the mangled child of a TIE fighter and Will's own A-Wing, and he'd promised it to Sergeant Vitale if it could be made to work. He was flying alongside the caravan while most of the others were on recon duty. Their sensor pings painted a tunnel map onto his screens, and he felt his eyelids flickering when Gorgeous Sue declared,
"Game time."
Will snapped to alertness.
"Enemies?"
he asked. Nath snickered. Ubellicos groaned with a rumble. Vitale, who was serving as the caravan's liaison to the squadron, said,
"You mean a proper game, right?"
"Who? What? Where?"
Sue said.
"Or to tears, might as well."
"Stay focused," Will wanted to say, but only because it was the sort of thing Quell or Renunja would have said to Alphabet or Riot Squadron. They all needed a distraction. The right thing to do was to let them have the game. So he did.
"Just keep half an eye on your scanner, okay? If anyone crashes, I'm gonna get the blame."
The pilots and Vitale debated who would go first. They nominated Nath, who seemed disinterested but good-humored. His Y-Wing stayed 400 meters ahead of the caravan.
"Who hears about my death first? Anyone who owes me credit might as well make their day. What's the cause? Some punk with a vibro knife who wants to make a name for himself. Where does it happen? One of the ecosystems. Always pictured myself retiring to a tube yacht there."
T5 chimed in the background. Vitale contended that Nath's what was insufficiently specific, and Sue and the others argued who would go next. Will thought of the last time he'd played, with Riot aboard the Hellion's Dare. They'd been on the run from Shadow Wing then, too, and he'd found the game at least as distasteful. They're bonding. Let it happen. Be part of it.
"Who?"
Vitale said.
"My nephew back on Corellia. Good kid, and I'd like him to remember his aunt." "What?" "Imperial Vizier Masameda's personal guard detail." "Where?" "Coruscant, obviously. We survived this mission, we're headed there sooner or later."
Sue was next, and she hit her notes with practiced flair.
"Who? My husband and love, Thage Howlus, wherever his black heart might be. What? Whatever Shadow Wing's using for a command ship when I ram the bridge with an airspeeder packed full of armed warheads. Where? Someplace along the Rima trade route, as we chase those bastards out of the core. How exactly do you intend to fly a humble hovercat out to the Rima?"
Dennis Rave asked.
"I hate calling it that,"
Sue answered.
"I'm flying a child's toy."
"Besides,"
Vitale called,
"Alphabet's got dibs on the Shadow Wing grudge."
"We can share,"
Nath said. Vitale laughed.
"What do you say, Will?"
He heard the playfulness and remembered their dinner with Alphabet among the refugees.
"Plenty of grudge to share, but let's hope we don't have to, huh?"
Ubellicos made a rude noise of disapproval, Vitale laughed, and the game went on. Rave was next, and he composed an intricate, minutes-long tale of his death from heart failure after saving his great-grandchildren in the final days of the war. Prince Pi clicked briefly about an oxygen overdose. Will knew his turn was rapidly approaching, and he made an effort to find something to share. Something disarming and honest instead of bleak. And all he could think of was, "I'm not planning to die. I'm not planning to let any of you die." A proximity alarm saved him from an answer. He checked his scanner and saw a mark moving through a side tunnel.
Enemy!
Vitali called.
Game time for real!
The TIE fighter flashed ghost-like above the rumblers and repulsor cars, pale in the illumination of its running lights and trailing the afterimage of its ion engines. Its scream echoed through the caverns, magnified and distorted. And Will found himself transfixed for precious seconds before he opened his throttle and gave chase.
One TIE,
he called.
Probably a scout attempting to pursue. Do not fire in the vicinity of the caravan. Last thing we need is a cave-in.
Last thing we need is 30 more of those guys,
Knapp corrected. The TIE pilot must have had the same concern. It did not fire as Will chased it past repulsor cars and Nath's Y-Wing. A few of the infantry shot low-powered particle volleys, but aside from wrecking Will's night vision, they had no effect. He shifted his eyes to his scanner until he readjusted, following the TIE into another tunnel branch. He wondered if he'd met the enemy pilot before. Blink would have recognized him and made contact. The others he'd known best by their ship's damage and their fighting styles, neither of which applied today.
How did they know where to look for us?
Ubelikos asked.
Someone must have seen the vehicles we nabbed,
Nath said.
Sort of implied we'd be going underground.
His voice gave way to distortion as Will's distance from the caravan increased. The A-Wing could easily keep pace with the TIE, and Will rarely lost sight of his quarry's lights. But the TIE pilot was skilled and, Will suspected, better rested, making frequent last-second course changes and descents into whole new strata of the underworld. In one narrow passage, Will had to tilt his fighter oblique to the rock or risk clipping his wings. The TIE was barely more slender than the A-Wing, but barely was enough to give it an advantage. Will shifted his body in his harness as if his own weight would provide the extra tilt he needed. His deflector screens shimmered as the electromagnetic field intersected the wall. The A-Wing trembled and jostled within the shield bubble. Will smelled burning wire and shut off his deflector screens altogether. Now we're even, he thought, watching the TIE. He saw his chance when they emerged into a broader cavern. The TIE spun and juddered, attempting to force Will to fly past into its field of fire. He retained his relative position and fumbled with his comm.
TIE fighter,
he called. He should have jammed all signals, but the fighter hadn't attacked. It galled him to take the first shot unprovoked.
Reduce speed and surrender immediately.
It wouldn't work. It didn't work. He reduced power to his weapons, bypassing a malfunctioning capacitor to do so, attempting to find an intensity that would damage the TIE without causing an avalanche if he missed. The TIE fired before he could. It bobbed upward, raking the cavern roof with particle fire an instant before its thrusters blazed. It was attempting to crush its pursuer and outrace the cavern's collapse. Will applied retro rockets and repulsors to brake and squeezed his trigger as G-forces squeezed him into his seat. He saw dust and the flash of his blaster cannons and veered starboard as the world fell and rumbled, trying to cut his velocity further and strike the avalanche sidelong instead of head first. Shouldn't have dropped her shields after all, he thought, and smiled and winced together. He heard stone striking metal, and the less melodic crack of debris against his canopy. A rain of boulders filled his peripheral vision. Inertia carried his port wing dangerously close to the destruction. He attempted to roll onto his starboard side, buy himself another meter of clearance, but he didn't know whether he'd succeeded until his stabilizers kicked in and he realized he was hanging in his harness. The rumbling stopped as the cave-in ceased. Dancing sparks illuminated the broken wing of a TIE fighter in the dark. The pilot's ploy had failed. He's bought the caravan some time, he thought, as sweat rolled down his cheek and dripped onto the side of his canopy. But if Shadow Wing had found them once, Shadow Wing could find them again. His squadron wasn't ready. There wasn't much to do. Splitting the caravan wasn't an option. It might keep a sizable number of soldiers safe from attack, but the ground vehicles would never reach the surface without aerial scouts.
We can park down here, fortify and prepare,
Twitch suggested when the commanders assembled via comm, and even she laughed at the idea.
Get all crushed when the foe drops one bomb, but we'd be fortified and prepared for it.
We keep rolling,
Carver said.
Get distance from where they found us and hope we reach the surface before long.
It wasn't a plan, but it was a declaration of intent, and Will didn't have anything superior to suggest. Quell would have had a superior idea, but Will wasn't as clever as Quell, or as experienced as Renunja. He explained the situation to his pilots, trying to mix compassion with determination as he finished.
For now, our job isn't to beat Shadow Wing or retake Troyth. It's to protect the rest of the troops. We're all tired, but we can do that much.
Gorgeous Sue, Denish Rave, Prince Pi, Ubelikos, and Nath Tenzint acknowledged the situation one by one. Will gave them their scouting assignments and was preparing for his own recon run when Nath asked,
Your cockpit smell like sweat and piss as much as mine does?
Will laughed despite himself.
Probably. I've been trying not to think about it.
When's the last time you climbed out, got some fresh air?
Nath paused.
Fresh as it gets down here, anyway.
Maybe 8 hours. I'm taking care of myself, Nath. Thank you.
There's perks to being commander. No one's stopping you from taking 4 hours to land on one of the rumblers and get some sleep.
That what you would have done when you had a squadron?
Will asked. He tried to keep judgment out of his voice. In truth, he did wonder how Nath would handle the situation.
Doesn't matter what I would have done, just telling you what I figure.
Will drummed his fingers on his console and nodded.
Nath?
Talk to me, brother.
Look out for the others, too. The way you do for me. They could use it. I could use it.
The others haven't been through what we've been through. I'll do what I can, but...
The 204th hit all of us. They've been through enough. Please.
Nath didn't say anything for a long while. Will thought he heard T5 burbling in the background alongside static and engine noise.
I'll do what I can,
Nath finally said. Please, Will thought, but he didn't say what he wanted to say, that in their game of who, what, where, only Nath had been bold enough to imagine a life after the war, that the others needed hope, no matter how cynical, and they would listen to Nath more than they would Will. Will was dreaming when the call came, his starfighter at rest atop the rumbler, and visions of honey blossoms filling his brain. The broad yellow petals dripped nectar onto his tongue. The sweet and tangy flavor filled him completely. But reality shredded the fantasy, and he heard Sue cry,
They're here!
Several frantic exchanges later, the situation became clear. A full Thai squadron was en route to the caravan, no more than 5 minutes from arrival. Sue had spotted them during recon and was now transmitting her scanner readings. Will detached his fighter from the rumbler but didn't lift off, trying to clear his mind as he reviewed maps of the nearest tunnels.
Not much room for ship-to-ship combat,
Nath said. The caravan was crossing a broad cavern amphitheater supported by gnarled pillars like petrified trees from the dawn of creation.
Prince Pi is so far ahead, we can't even get him on comms. How do you want to play this?
Could try to block them.
Will ran a gloved fingertip over the map, strapping on his flight helmet with his other hand.
Find a choke point. Collapse the tunnel like the Thai tried earlier.
Gorgeous Sue sounded grim.
You said buried himself?
Vitali's voice was clipped and irritable.
Carver's ordering weapons out. We're not stopping the caravan, but maybe we'll get lucky with a blaster shot or two.
Shooting down a Thai with handhelds would be challenging, but not impossible. The soldiers were disciplined and experienced, and the cavern didn't provide room for the fighters to stay out of blaster range. But the ground troops were also packed together. That meant the TIEs could obliterate multiple vehicles in a single pass, killing 20 or 30 or 50 at once.
They haven't seen us yet,
Will said.
Sue, I'm heading to your position. The two of us will draw them away from the caravan and reunite with the troops later.
The caravan was climbing one side of the amphitheater, heading for a misshapen tunnel entrance, barely large enough for the tunnel tanks. The rumblers strained at the ascent, smashing delicate spires as they went.
You break off now, you'll never find us again,
Vitali called. Will's shoulders tightened. She was right to worry, but it hurt to hear her fear.
Sue, jam all frequencies on my mark. Nath, you and Dennis stay with the caravan. If I can't make it back, take command and I'll try to find you on the surface.
This is a bad plan, brother,
Nath growled. Will could see the Y-Wing's thruster fires ahead of him as the caravan entered the tunnel. Carver's voice came through a second later. The infantry commander didn't hide his disdain.
Your plan is not approved. We can't afford to lose two ships. We're fighting a damn air war.
I'm in charge of the squadron,
Will said.
Sue, activate jammers.
Yes, sir,
Sue said, though there was a flatness in her tone that Will couldn't interpret. The comm filled with static. Will activated his own jammers and lifted off the rumbler, eyeing the tunnel maps and hoping he could navigate the labyrinth in time to reach Sue. Engine vibrations shook his body, and he watched the serpent of the caravan crawl beneath him. The tiny figures of soldiers, crouched atop vehicles with rifles and portable cannons, looked as delicate as a child's toys. He had barely enough room to wheel his ship around. The caravan still extended past the tunnel mouth into the amphitheater, and beyond the opening, he saw a flash of emerald. The TIEs were approaching, firing on Gorgeous Sue. He opened his throttle and felt his ship rattle as loose armor plating flapped and Durasteel bolts strained. You're tired too, he murmured, but he smiled. This was his mission. He would fight Shadow Wing and save lives, and he would do it all enveloped by primal geological wonders. If this was how he died away from home, he'd be content. Who, what, where? The last of the caravan vehicles, a 20-passenger mining car, lurched into the tunnel entrance as Will approached. He slowed, intending to skirt its bulk as it moved into the tunnel proper, but the car, too, slowed and then stopped. He saw another flash of emerald beyond the entrance and tried to determine what was going on. The shockwave hit him hard. He snapped backward against his seat as his ship lurched and white light flooded his cockpit. He heard the thunder of a quake, as he had during the cave-in caused by the TIE, but no alerts flashed on his console, and nothing impacted his ship. He pulled to a halt and waited, fingers gripping his firing trigger. When the dust dispersed, he peered at the mound of rubble where the tunnel mouth had been. The last of the mining cars was gone, and Will felt sick with certainty that he knew what had transpired. He deactivated his jammers and waited for confirmation. Carver called for a stop 6 hours later to repair an overheating repulsor car. Will landed and walked on unsteady legs across uneven ground. When he returned from staring into the crystal-encrusted abyss of a nameless chasm lit only by phosphorescence, a sight he hoped to remember until the end of his days, despite the circumstances, Nath Tenzint intercepted him a stone's throw from the caravan and their ships. You doing all right? Nath asked. I am, Will said. The older man pulled a stick of chewable calf from his pocket, tore it in half, bit into one portion, and held the other out to Will. Will took it after a moment of hesitation. We were too late to do a blasted thing about Sue, Nath said. Whatever we did, she was outnumbered and too close to escape. You see that, right?
I do.
He did. The 20 soldiers aboard the mining car, the soldiers who detonated their own vehicle to keep Shadow Wing from pursuing, were another matter. But Nath didn't ask about them, and Will didn't bring up their sacrifice. He'd aired his distress to Carver. It should have been my call, and been overruled already. Instead, he asked, "Are we making the wrong decision, planning a counterattack like this?" and hoped Nath understood his meaning. "You tell me. You wanted to leave the city, we left the city. You agreed we had to act, and that an air force was our best shot. Folks are dying to make all that happen, so if you've got another idea, it's a good time to speak up." It wasn't what Will had been hoping to hear. "I know. Right now, though, I could use some perspective." "You don't want my perspective." Nath glanced at the caravan, where soldiers and pilots squatted on vehicle roofs or laughed at ribald jokes under yawning cracks in the cave ceiling. "I'm on your side, but if you want someone to inspire you, you want someone to inspire Rave and Prince Pi and Ubelikos and Vitali? I don't know them any better than you do, and I don't care to. That's not what I'm here for." Will stared at his friend. In time, he forced down his outrage and gloom and spoke as a commander was meant to speak. "All right," he said. "Let's keep moving." Four. Soren Keyes walked with Governor Farah Yadiz down the path they'd come to enjoy together over the past days, a route that took them above Radakia Plaza, on the drift platforms and over to the rooftop gardens of the Ta complex. Yadiz had told him that the sub-level greenhouse utilized a climate emulator. "Have you ever experienced snowfall, Colonel?" she asked as they alighted in the tear blossom glade. "Not in a hollow or through a viewport, but actually felt it?"
"I grew up on a world with 8-month winters," Soren answered. "I know what it feels like."
But he smiled as he said it, and the words brought back the taste of mulled Rordash root cider and the ache of cheeks numbed by frost. "Then I wish we had the power to spare so that you could tell me whether the climate emulator is any substitute for reality." She shrugged. "Then again, I hear the New Republic intends to repurpose Hoth as a prison for those who remain loyal to the Empire. Maybe I'll have my chance someday." It was not a rumor that Soren had heard, nor one that seemed credible. For all the New Republic's hypocrisies, its chancellor was dedicated to a pretext of justice over punishment. Repurposing Hoth, the icy world where the rebels had been so badly defeated, had too much poetry. He'd begun to respond when Yadiz cut him off.
"Ignore my self-pity. You were telling me about Cor 9?
"I was. My scouts arrived this morning and found the facility intact, much as your files described. They confirmed the presence of a bulk ore freighter in the launch bay, more than a century old and infested with Minox, but structurally sound."
"The freighter interests you?"
"It does."
He could have left it at that, and she might not have questioned him. Yet he'd gone over the conversation in his mind already and chosen the path he believed best served his cause. "If it could be made operational, it could provide an advantage in our mission."
"How much ore were you expecting to take from Troyth, Colonel?"
The humor in her words was absent from her eyes, which watched him keenly as they walked the gravel path through the gardens. Soren paused to kneel beside a condenser coil wrapped with a yellow vine sporting iridescent green blossoms. He inhaled an odor reminiscent of chandrillon vanilla.
"Both my Star Destroyer and my carrier are gone. Consider what would be possible if we armed the freighter for combat. It would require a larger engineering crew than I can field, but there may be weapons salvageable from the wreckage of the Edict. If mounted aboard the freighter..."
He trailed off to allow Yadiz to develop the fantasy as she wished. Part of him even meant what he implied.
"It would still be a freighter," she said, "albeit one capable of smashing mountains. You could strike at facilities deep in enemy territory without risking your ties. Maybe even claim control of the planet's defense shields."
Several of the shield generator installations had fallen into Imperial hands already. Others had proved less tractable.
You understand, then,
he said, and rose to face Yadiz.
I do, Colonel. However I can help you and your mission, I will.
They continued their walk, discussing the particulars of the project, where to source the engineers, how to transport them to the wreckage of the Edict and Core 9, how long it would take before the freighter was ready, and whether Core 9 could be secured before General Syndulla's remnant arrived there. These subjects put Sorin on more comfortable ground, and it might have been a conversation with any companionable agent of the Empire. It was easy for him to forget the true purpose of the freighter, that he had seized on it as the answer to his troubles, the one starship on Troyth large enough to carry a wing of TIE fighters off-world and into hyperspace. To ensure the 204th's survival, he needed it. With regrets, he would have to leave Troyth's survival to the Governor. Like Sorin, she was responsible for her own people first and foremost. That night, Sorin attended the service for Lieutenant Garmin Nadra, who had been lost in the caverns beneath Troyth during Squadron 3's efforts to locate the enemy remnant. Nadra was the first pilot lost since the battle against the Lodestar, and therefore the first who could be honored properly, as an individual instead of as one loss among many. Sorin had known Nadra well, though he'd spent little time with her in the past year. He'd mentored her shortly after her graduation from the academy, humored her desire for tactical plans and custom simulator drills over the course of months until she had become a confident soldier. Nadra had never expressed the ethical reservations others had, never even spoken to Sorin about why she'd enlisted. She had only wanted to become a better pilot and conquer her fears by doing so. He said none of this at the small gathering led by Captain Dorita in the Ta Complex Gardens. Imperial military regulations discouraged formal memorial services, but every unit had its own discreet traditions. Aboard the Pursuer, that had meant a short ceremony performed by Colonel Nares to celebrate the elevation of the officer next in line, followed by a private reading by the appropriate squadron commander of any testament left by the deceased and the distribution of personal belongings. Nadra's possessions and testament, if any, had been left aboard the Aerie, and her body and tie were lost underground. There was nothing to remember her by, nor anyone to elevate in her place. So the squadron told stories in the timeless manner of soldiers. Dorita gave Sorin a glare of defiance when the reminiscing began, as if she held him responsible for this death, if not all the others. But he took no offense, and he shared his own tales of Nadra when the time came. Late in the night, they started a fire from the brittle branches of wilting foliage and talked about Black Tar Cyst and the chase through the Red Space Reefs, where the Pursuer had earned its name. In mourning Nadra, Sorin allowed himself to mourn Palal Sidia, whom he had led to defeat over Katadra. He'd wished to know her better and to see her achieve her potential. Van Bregeer, too, had been a profound loss to the wing. Gaborone's absence continued to strike Sorin often during the day. He'd had no time to bid farewell to them, to remember or honor them. But he could mourn Nadra. For the first time since Sorin's return to the 204th, he felt like he was again among his people. They had changed, and he had changed, but they were shadowing nonetheless, and he was glad that they were his. He woke from dreams of flight in which Rickton, whom he had known in his life as Devon, served as his wingmate on their mission to avenge Garmin Nadra. But Nadra became Farah Yadiz, then Irika Quell, and Rickton and Quell both died in the New Republic prison camp called Traitor's Remorse. And when the comm call jolted Sorin from his bed and summoned him to the makeshift landing field in the plaza, he was glad for it. Yadiz had sent the message and met him there. She was dressed in an informal coat of thin violet fabric that fell to her ankles and billowed in the breeze. He wondered if she'd risen on short notice as well. Soren had worn his flight suit often over the past days, but tonight it had seemed absurd, and he'd pulled on an ill-fitting nobleman's shirt and slacks one of the supply crews had found. Yadiz didn't look exhausted. Instead, her expression was brighter than he'd ever seen, and there was a buoyancy to her step.
"Colonel," she said, "I have a gift for you."
"A gift?" She tilted her head as if straining not to look back at the field of ties, all of them showing scars of battle by now, including the ones freshly salvaged from the Jarbanoff junkyard. Among the starfighters sat a boxy atmospheric skyhopper that might have once been considered luxurious, but struck Soren as dated and utilitarian. Not one of the 204ths, which meant it belonged to the governor's people.
"The first crews arrived this morning," Yadiz said. "They spent all day with the wreckage of your star destroyer and told me they found something I thought you'd want to see."
Soren spotted movement on the skyhopper's ramp. Two ununiformed men with the bearing of Imperial officers descended, frequently looking behind them. Yadiz kept talking.
"The governor, Governor Hastemore, shouldn't have known, but he had eyes and ears in strange places, and I recognized it from his files. I don't know..."
She cut herself off as a third figure descended the ramp, weaving as if inebriated or grievously wounded. Soren saw the hem of the figure's robes first, red cloth and leather that never brushed the ground. The slender silhouette of the torso followed, unremarkable except for the left arm severed midway between elbow and shoulder. Nothing bound or concealed the stump. The wires that hung sparked and popped. Soren had no wish to look upon the figure's face, but the compulsion overwhelmed him. The glass plate was unmarred, if smeared with ash, and from within, a light flickered. A holographic face, aged and waxen with sunken eyes and a crease of a mouth held in a scowl or a smirk. The sapphire light blurred into static, reformed an instant later, then disappeared altogether. Soren knew what he looked upon. He did not understand how it had survived the obliteration of the Airy or found the wreckage of the Edict.
"It is the messenger, isn't it?"
Yadiz asked.
"Of course,"
Soren said. His pilots had changed without him and changed again upon his return. He had hoped their fall to Troyth had freed them from their past. Yet there was no escaping the shadow of the Emperor. Chapter 17, Shattered Worlds and Nightmares. 1. The next time Chasna Chaddock met the prisoner of the Children of the Empty Sun, the Imperial pilot had been released from the medical suite and permitted to mingle with the cultists. She hobbled on steel crutches, remained in her flight suit, and was accompanied by a pair of medics who looked more like guards. The three of them passed by the laundry pool as Chas was scrubbing a shirt,